It's 5:37 here on Galesburg's Evening News. I'm Tori Cavanaugh, and happy to welcome back to our studios tonight Ralph Bud Lindroth. I'm sure you know him as Bud, and he's here in the studios tonight. He's a former BNSF conductor, and he's written what I believe is his second book, and it's the history of the CB&Q Quincy branch, and that, of course, includes the Northern Cross route Quincy to Galesburg. So welcome, Bud, back to the studios tonight. He's got a book signing coming up this weekend. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But, Bud, great to have you here, and thanks so much for showing me the new book and letting me know how you've been occupying your time here for what looks like it could have been a couple of years' work.
Thank you, Terry. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
So tell me a little bit about, just by way of background, your career with Burlington Northern and BNSF and how you came to write not only the first book, but you know, how the second one then came about.
Okay. I started in June of 70 as a summer switchman. And I was hired back in April 71 on the road. And most of my trips were either to Quincy or to Savannah, which would be covered under the Peavine book. And I asked a lot of questions, you know, about where does this track go? Or why? What's that bridge over there with no track on it? What's all this? So finally, I decided it was very interesting. I was always interested in history of the line. So I wrote the Peavine book before I retired, and then I accumulated all this material about the Quincy line in the process. So I thought I might as well just go ahead and do one on the Quincy line.
I don't think that's unusual, is it, for authors to have so much information at hand that then they have to distinguish what they want to go in one book and really Can I do another?
Yes, that's
this
correct.
Is extensive, Bud.
It's about twice the size of the first book. And Randy Daniel from West Burlington did all the graphics in the book and did a great job. He took some pictures that have been in other books, but he does such a good job on working the pictures and getting all the maximum light or whatever he needs to do, enlarge or reduce.
Yeah, it's impressive just to me on the photographs alone, Bud, and that was one of the questions I had. You know, where did they all come from? Because really, I don't want to call it a picture book because the history is there in it too, but the pictures are phenomenal. I mean, there's that one when they're going across a bridge. Well, the bridge has been washed out. It's been flooded out. Mm-hmm. And you just see tracks just stopping. The steel just stops.
Yes.
Go ahead.
The pictures, probably the best pictures that I was not expecting to get was from a gentleman named Phil Weibler. He lives in Chicago now, a retired engineer, but he lived in Quincy there up through high school, and he took a lot of pictures, and it's a good thing he did because his pictures were just outstanding, and he has some pictures of the inside of the depot, the Quincy depot that was torn down around 62, the only ones I could find.
I was going to say, is that the one that almost looks like a church and had a big spire on top?
Yes.
Yeah,
that's
you've
correct.
Got full page of those pictures,
Bud. There's four double page shots of that one from each angle because every corner of the depot looks completely different and there's other things going on every part of the depot.
Did you get to archive? Do we have archival photos? I mean, is that where some of this came from, too?
Yes, WIU Archives gave me a lot of the Macomb and Colchester area. The Quincy Library gave me a lot of pictures about new bridge that was built and how it made a loop around the yard so they didn't have to back in anymore, and all the industry. There's a lot of pictures of the industries that the railroad served in that area, and those all came from the Quincy Archives.
Mm-hmm.
And other people that were known picture takers that Mr. Daniel knew, he brought those pictures in because he knew these people, and in some cases he had access to their collections.
Yeah, the collection of pictures is astounding because it looks like they run almost from, I don't know, the late 1800s through the present time.
Yes,
in terms of what you're trying to portray here.
That's correct. I don't want to admit Knox College, Carly Robeson gave me some, and Mary McAndrew gave me some great pictures of the yard out here. There are two complete chapters just on Galesburg and one passenger chapter that's mostly Galesburg photos. So they were a big help as well.
Yeah. Bud, let's talk a little bit about the CB&Q Quincy branch and the Northern Cross itself, which kind of looks like a cross. That's, I'm sure that's probably how it got its name.
Well, actually, no, it's a different scenario. The state of Illinois had the legislature passed what they called Improvement Act in about 1838, and they decided they wanted one railroad to go down the middle of the state, which was the Illinois Central. And then there were two other railroads. One would go across, it was called the Northern Cross, because it was the old wagon trail crossing. So that's where the Northern Cross. And then there was the Southern Cross south of that. So the Northern Cross was originally supposed to go to Clayton, then over to Maridosia on the Illinois River, then to Springfield, Decatur, Danville, over to Indiana. But the only part that we were that concerns the story is between there and Camp Point. And then later on, a different railroad built the piece from Camp Point to Clayton. And then the Wabash ended up getting most of the track from Jacksonville on over to the Indiana state line. So the only piece that we used was between Quincy and Camp Point.
That's the only part of that Northern Cross
The whole track. That's the only piece that we used.
But then from Camp Point, the big construction where your book really gets into, isn't it from Camp Point then to Maridosia and then the railroads that took it all the way to Indiana?
Yes, actually, there was some negotiations with the Central Military Tract, which was building from Aurora to Galesburg.
Right.
And so those financiers, mostly from the East Coast, they hooked up with the Mr. Bushnell. Nehemiah Bushnell was the president of the Northern Cross. And they said, well, we want to go all the way to Quincy. And he said, well, that's fine, but we need to work on both sections of the railroad at the same time, because he was afraid they'd build the eastern end first and then forget about the western end. So they agreed to that. And so they actually worked on both pieces at the same time.
I was going to say, one of the descriptions in the book, that's what I thought. I was going to ask you, I thought it looks like there was simultaneous construction, one going east to Indiana and the other coming up to make that connection with Galesburg, which at the time it looked like was pretty highly touted because of our forefathers here who had the college and the foresight for a lot of things and were instrumental in getting that to go.
Yes, there's a early railroad was from Springfield to Jacksonville. I'm supposed to go to Maridosia and eventually did, but they bypassed Maridosia later and it was more of a branch line. But there's a monument there at the Maridosia Depot. It said on that line ran the first engine west of the Allegheny Mountains. And there's a little picture of it. It's a big marble tablet.
Yeah, interesting. But what was interesting, too, Bud, was it looked like, I don't think we always hear necessarily about the Illinois legislature getting involved in all of all this construction now of railroads. Was this peculiar to the time, or was this the way things happened?
This was quite common because everyone wanted a railroad in their vicinity. So the legislators would propose a route, and sometimes it'd be modified. And for instance, the one that ran south out of Quincy that went down on the Illinois side to East Hannibal, it was supposed to go through Payson. But through a little political maneuvering, it didn't.
That's just
one example. Yeah. But the first chapter is almost all text, and it talks about all the different improvement acts and acts of the legislature to modify the first act and the second act. And they kept doing whatever it took to get that railroad going, basically.
Yeah, and then eventually with they did the two lines, one all the way to Indiana and running right up so you could connect Quincy with Chicago, which was the big thing, right?
Yes,
the
it was.
Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy
route.
But did they run into a lot of issues? Because at the time that they started these types of buildings, we're talking steam engine time, right?
Yes.
I mean, and a land that was, I would say, had to be primarily prairie.
Yes. The only obstacle they really ran into was from Avon to Galesburg, there was quite a grade. And so they built from Quincy in pieces, and they opened the line up as they went. They went to Plymouth, and then they went to Colchester, and then they went to Macomb. And when they got to Avon, they actually worked between Galesburg and Abingdon first.
Oh.
And the piece between Abingdon and Avon was the very last. So the people that got off at Avon had to take a stagecoach over to Abington and then get a train the rest of the way.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Just because of the way the land was shaped.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty interesting. It was interesting how much a mile that railroad costs,
yes,
too, wasn't
yes,
it? That sounded phenomenal to me. I'm like,
yes,
wow.
There's a lot of figures in there, mm-hmm, about what things cost, because it was kind of interesting just to see what it cost to build a mile of track or a depot or a roundhouse.
Yeah.
Everything was in the annual report with the price tag right down to the cents.
Yeah. How much of this exists now, Bud? Are there, you know, we know Quincy to Chicago does, but what about the other ways?
Well, everything's basically still there. The old freight house at Bushnell, I talked to some people several months ago, and they actually gained control of that now, and they're going to restore it.
Oh.
And I haven't been in there. I've been in the depot at Avon.
Mm-hmm.
They let me have a tour of that, and we've got some pictures of the interior of the Avon Depot. The main places where it's changed is back in the middle 50s, the CB&Q was trying to compete with the Santa Fe for the passenger business to Kansas City. So they went through basically straightening out the track. And you can see these places where they actually reduced the grade or they made it straighter so they could, mm-hmm, run faster. And there's four or five places you can still see where the old track used to run. But other than that, it's the same roadbed that they started with back in 1856.
Yeah, most of it still there.
Yes.
And I'm sure there were challenges as well. As Quincy crosses the Mississippi, you need trestles, and I'm not sure what they needed really from west to east to Indiana. If they, well, over the Illinois, probably there, or if it does at all.
The actual, the biggest problem they had was getting across the Mississippi. And early on, from January of 56 when they began operations, mm-hmm, till 1868, they just basically ran right down to the river and let people off, and they got on the riverboats and went north or south.
Okay.
Well, then in 1868, they completed the bridge across the Mississippi, and then that opened up the line to run, mm-hmm, over to Kansas City, to Hannibal, mm-hmm, and St. Joe. They hooked up with them. They had a line up to Burlington on both sides of the river and a line down to Hannibal on both sides of the river. So there were more passenger trains running out of Quincy until about 1900 than there were out of Galesburg. Mm-hmm. So it was really the hub of the Burlington was really Quincy in the early days.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, we don't like to admit that, but it is true because they had a lot more access to different passenger trains, different,
sure,
markets. They could go to Burlington and hook, mm-hmm, up with that line. They could go to St. Louis and hook up with all the other, mm-hmm, southern lines. They can go on both sides of the river. And, of course, they could run to Galesburg. So,
yeah, and it looked, Bud, too, that there was a lot of competition for who owned the railroad or who had shares of the railroad.
Yes.
I think it's much more consolidated now. But at that time, it looked like there were a lot of players.
Yes, yes.
We're talking about the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, interesting. Well, it's photography is astounding to me. That's to me the key to the whole book outside,
yes,
of its history is,
yes,
the photographs that have survived.
Right.
That really give you an idea of the early days of the railroad there. Not to mention all your little towns. I mean, it was nice because you went through the little towns and what they had and, mm-hmm, what role they may have played. Mm-hmm. Quincy was a big hub, but you've got a lot. Lomax and Carmen and all these other little venues that the rails went through. So
yes, and there were three or four towns that aren't, mm-hmm, there anymore. One has an interesting story that goes with it. The town was called Cleola, and it was just between Camp Point and Quincy. And there was a very poor picture that I wanted in,
uh-huh,
and Randy did the best he could with it. But then I found an article in the Quincy newspaper because the Quincy Library has archives of all the. So we went through and looked at all the articles, and one of them said that when the agent at Cleola passed away, his wife became the agent, and she was known for keeping a spotless depot and having beautiful flower beds around. So guess what's in the very front of this picture? A big bed of flowers, white, uh-huh, flowers, and there's a family coming out getting ready to get on the train.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of tied that together. That's just one example of all the stories we found,
yeah,
in the Quincy newspaper.
I know we're going to run out of time before I get to ask you a lot about the stories that are in here, but tell us, Bud, where the book is available and about your book signing on the weekend.
Okay. Right now, the book is here in Galesburg. It's available at the Railroad Museum.
Okay.
They're open every day, but Monday 10 to 4, and then on noon, it's on Sunday, it's noon to 4. The Galesburg Welcome Center has them as well. And then there are other places in Macomb and Quincy that have them as well.
All right. And I suspect if you're any kind of history buff, especially about the railroads, this is a pretty big encyclopedia, I'd say. Of,
five pounds, 2 ounces.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, 1,040 pictures.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, and I thought, I'm not going to ask him. I don't know if he counted them all. Over 1,000 pictures, but they're stunning. And a lot of them that Randy did a great job of opening them up. Who published the book?
Did you Randy? And
Randy
and I,
published.
Yeah,
okay,
basically.
Yeah, because it's we're talking hardbound book here. We're not talking about a paperback.
No,
we're talking a hardbound. Looks like something we'd pick up if we were in the college bookstore in terms of history, bud. But it's the photographs are stunning. It's really nice to see. You're in a few of them too, by the way. So that's nice.
Thank you.
Yep. All right. Bud Lindroth has been our guest here. I wish we had more time because I'm sure he has more stories, so maybe we'll connect again at some point down the road. But extensive coverage of Galesburg's railroad history, a history of the CB&Q Quincy branch, and then the Northern Cross Route Quincy to Galesburg is the book. He'll be at the upstairs meeting room at the Galesburg Public Library this Saturday from 2 to 4 signing books, right, Bud?
Correct.
Yeah. So if you want to talk to Bud or get the book signed, and again, you'll find it at the Galesburg Railroad Museum and also at the Convention and Visitors Bureau here in town. So check it out. Bud, appreciate your time tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.